Welcome to The Parish, a community of ordinary people walking together in the way of Jesus. The messages are just one part of the Sunday morning experience, and we hope you join us for worship and the rhythm experience soon. We meet at 9:30 a.m. on Sunday mornings.
Hi again, at least to those who've shared this space with me before, or nice to meet you for those of you who I'm being introduced to for the first time. The quick version, my name is Amber Vernon, and I am a supporter of the parish tuning in from Richmond, Virginia. I describe myself generally as a gray area kind of person. I even more gray as I'm here with you today. And if you spend any time with me, you'll get very used to hearing me say, yes, but, or yes, and, or well, both can be true. One of my very favorite quotes that fits into kind of this category, it honestly comes to mind for me even more than scripture sometimes, is by the Austrian poet and novelist Rainer Maria Rilke, or Rilke. It comes from his book, Letters to a Young Poet, and reads, "Be patient towards all that is unsolved in your heart and try to love the questions themselves like locked rooms and like books that are now written in a very foreign language. Do not seek the answers which cannot be given you because you would not be able to live them. And the point is to live everything. Live the questions now. Perhaps you will then gradually, without noticing it, live along some distant day into the answer." And these themes of uncertainty and patience and the unknown and the living alongside of unanswered questions seem to be the same themes that have been addressed so beautifully during this series. Jordan introduced the series, if you remember, walking us through kind of this general concept of ambiguity. He was followed by Nancy, who spoke about forgiveness, Jeff, who spoke about humility, Ryan, who spoke about certainty, and Garrett, who spoke last week about faith. I've had a chance to listen to these messages, and I'm so grateful for the mental, emotional, and spiritual work that they did to share with us. My ongoing encouragement is to find those messages on the podcast if you missed any, or even re-listen to them. Sometimes even the second or third listen kind of is more powerful even than the first. And so here we are, the last weekend of May, and I think, although I'm not entirely sure, that I might be the one closing us out on this series. I mean, I guess that unsurety about whether or not this is the last one seems fitting. In my initial discussion with Nicole in preparation for this series, she described it as one that would be approaching kind of gray area topics, my favorite, like I said, speaking on a topic perhaps where I used to think one way and now I think another way, or maybe one where I just still struggle to reconcile what I've been taught and what I believe. And I jokingly replied, "Oh, like how I'm not even sure I'm allowed to be speaking at all in church." And so this topic was born. You may be surprised to hear that I struggle in this context, especially as I'm speaking to you right now, because honestly, in most areas of my life, I have no problem speaking. In fact, I have to check myself for speaking too much. I talk so much that it makes some people uncomfortable. My husband and kids have been known to ask me directly not to talk to people when we are out in public because they find it so embarrassing. I'm just as comfortable speaking in front of a room of 100 people as I am in maybe a more intimate setting of 2 to 3 people. And yet when it comes to speaking in a church context, it's different. I feel unsure. I feel unsteady. I feel anxious. I feel full of doubt. Even when I'm incredibly confident about what I'm saying, there's this nagging voice that asks, "Who do you think you are?" And these questions haven't quieted just because I keep showing up in church spaces and opening my mouth. And they're likely going to be rolling around in my head after I record this, and I know you're listening to it. Who are you? Who do you think you are? Those questions about who can and can't speak in a church context, who has the authority to speak, talk about ambiguous messaging. I don't know the backgrounds of who all's sitting in this room today. In fact, I don't even know who all is in the room today, let alone your backgrounds. But I'll venture a guess that if you grew up in a church or you know somebody who grew up in a church, or seriously, even if you've seen a movie or a TV show that featured church, there's probably some awareness that the religious structures kind of broadly place these limits or these definitions about who has the authority to speak and what type of speech they are kind of allowed to engage in. Now, I was raised in a faith tradition that provided some pretty mixed messages about who had the authority to speak. There was a full reliance on lay clergy, which basically means that all the leadership roles were provided to people on a volunteer basis. No one had special training or special credentials or certain kind of education. We didn't have pastors or preachers. And each Sunday in kind of the main meeting, members of the congregation were asked to speak on a particular topic. And there was always a youth speaker, kind of a young adult speaker, an adult female speaker, and an adult male speaker. And one Sunday a month, we basically had the church equivalent of like an open mic night with more lighting and less alcohol, basically for like 90 minutes, just anybody could get up and share their testimony, maybe an informal statement, not planned, not written, about their conversion or about a particular faith experience. And in many ways, my experience from a very young age told me that everyone and anyone had the equal authority to get up in front of the congregation and speak, and all voices were equal. And yet, which you probably knew was coming, as I got older, I learned it was more complicated. You see, women weren't allowed to be the last speaker on Sundays. It always had to be a man. If someone was under church discipline, they might be prevented from speaking in church or even in praying publicly in the congregation. Men are given what's called the priesthood, which is a certain type of power and authority that's not granted to women. To make it more complicated, part of the church's history is also tied up in race being a determining factor about which men could even hold the priesthood. And when I left that faith tradition, a whole other topic of ambiguity in of itself, I wasn't ready to walk away from church altogether. And so I started this long process of finding a new church, and each time I watched who spoke in front of the room and who didn't. And I asked questions about who was allowed to speak and who wasn't and when and how. And I got all sorts of different answers, sometimes from congregations even in the same denomination. And these answers were tied up in gender and education and credentials and sexuality and just all sorts of things. Things that were truly baffling to me. And I've continued to struggle to reconcile all these rules and regulations I've been exposed to over the years about who has the authority to speak in a church context with my just really deeply held beliefs that we each are loved and known by a relational God, a God that wants relationship with us and wants us in relationship with each other. And I don't see how we can be in relationship with God or in relationship with each other if we're not all using our voices. And as I've reflected on this topic for the past few weeks, what really stands out to me is how much these rules around who has the authority to speak privilege and empower some voices while devaluing and silencing others. The church now and historically does not exist outside of the world or outside of any particular historical time frame. And we in the church are not immune or protected from the same dynamics that are happening everywhere else around power and privilege and voice and access. And so I've repeatedly circled back to this question, well, who benefits? Who benefits when only certain voices from certain positions or certain identities are the ones who are allowed to speak? Who benefits from the rules that say people without certain positions or certain identities are not allowed to speak? Who grants or who benefits from granting or withholding that authority? One of the reasons I support the parish is that intentional and consistent efforts have been made from day one to step out of these rules and regulations. From the beginning, there's been this foundational belief that each one of us has something valuable to say, that we can learn from each other, revolutionary, and that this relational learning can impact how we understand and how we follow Christ. And even though we may value this, it doesn't mean it's easy. If you came from a background that says women can't preach, or that only ordained clergy can share a sermon, then this moment, even right now, is probably super uncomfortable for you, because I'm a woman and I have no credentials or ordination from anybody. Not only could it be a barrier to really hearing the members from your community who get up and speak, it could also get in the way of your willingness to respond to a request that you share a message. And as I prepared this message to share with you, I kind of started down this path of reviewing various scriptures that have been held up as the rationale for implementing these stringent rules about who could and couldn't speak. And I was thinking, you know, maybe I'll go through each of them and kind of show the discrepancies or give examples of how they've been used for or against certain people. And the truth is, it just made me sad. It brought up so many memories from childhood, really up until now, of ways portions of this beautiful book have been used to diminish my voice and the voice of so many others. And in that delightful space, as I'm sad and I'm thinking of these experiences, the story of Esther came to me. And so that's the story that I want to share with you today. Quick overview. Esther was a member of a Jewish community who was living within the capital city of the Persian Empire. Long story short, the king gets mad at the queen because she won't show up to a party with his very drunk friends to kind of be shown off. Can't imagine why. So she's kicked out. She's no longer the queen. And the king ends up holding I'll just call it a beauty pageant. So the king hosts this beauty pageant to find a new queen. And so Esther ends up winning, which I don't know how happy she was about it, but winning this contest. But she's kept her Jewish identity secret, which again is understandable given the context. And so then this variety of backroom scheming ensues, and there's all this stuff with ego and power, and as there often is. And one of the king's chosen leaders ends up kind of getting the king to decree death to all Jews. And so Esther, in her role as queen, has to decide what to do. Esther's been granted some degree of authority through her role as queen and in her relationship to the king, but it's not like it's this equal relationship. The rules are that no one can just walk in and talk to the king, not even the queen. And let's remember, she's also a Jew, which the king doesn't know. So Esther holds power and privilege, and she also lacks power and privilege. All are true at once, and Esther's faced with this choice about whether or not to use her authority and her voice to speak, a choice that could come at a cost of potentially her life. And so in Esther 4, we're brought into the story as Esther's in communication with her uncle Mordecai, basically the man who raised her. And Mordecai is pleading with Esther to use her voice to speak against the decree of death for the Jewish people. And so after he asks this of her in verses 9 to 11, she responds, "Everyone who works for the king here and even the people out in the provinces knows that there is a single fate for every man or woman who approaches the king without being invited. Death. The one exception is if the king extends his gold scepter, then he or she may live. And it's been 30 days now since I've been invited to come to the king." She says, "Look, it doesn't matter who I am or what power you or anyone else thinks I may have. If I step outside of the rules to go before the king uninvited, I will lose everything, even my life." And Mordecai writes back, he's undeterred. He writes back to her in verses 12 to 14, "Don't think that just because you live in the king's house, you're the one Jew who will get out of this alive. If you persist in staying silent at a time like this, help and deliverance will arrive for the Jews from someplace else, but you and your family will be wiped out. Who knows? Maybe you were made queen for just such a time as this." In so many words, his challenge back to his niece is, "You've been given authority that others don't have. Maybe this is the time to use it. Your voice can help yourself and others." That reminder of her authority, her identity, the importance of her voice seemed to be enough. And in verses 15 to 16, Esther commits to speaking despite the danger. She says, "I'll go to the king, even though it's forbidden. If I die, I die." And she does just that, the speaking part, not the dying part. In chapter 7, verses 3 to 4, she boldly says to the king, If I have found favor in your eyes, O king, and if it please the king, give me my life and give my people their lives. We've been sold, I and my people, to be destroyed, sold to be massacred and eliminated. You're welcome to read the full story in a more detailed telling of what came before and what came after, but I want to stop there and explore a few points with the remaining time we have. I know I started off talking about authority and speaking within a church context, and that's really a narrow version of applicability because for those of you who've never thought of or wanted to speak in church, you probably checked out like 10 minutes ago, but I've got some bad news. I think the points I'm going to explore here will make it applicable for everyone. So recently, I've been feeling, and again, just transparency, pretty angry and tired and betrayed and disappointed and hopeless. And I don't know how else to feel as I watch laws being debated or enacted that I see as causing direct harm. And I don't know how else to feel as I watch multiple communities just actively grieving deaths of their loved ones at the hands of someone who is committed to their destruction. I'm confident that you can relate to those feelings too. And kind of the accompanying confusion about what in the world to do or what to say. And maybe like me, you look around in these broken places in your home or your neighborhood, in your school, in your workplace, maybe even in your church, in your voting district, in this nation, in the world. You see these places where power is imbalanced and voices are silenced, and you wonder, what can my voice do? What do I have to say kind of that's important that could make a change at this time and in this place? And just like that question that rolled around for me as I shared earlier about who do you think you are, it maybe rolls around for you too. Who do you think you are to show up, to command attention, to speak? So I'm hoping we can learn from the example of Esther. Esther was given a place of authority which allowed her access to power. I would argue that each of us in some way or another has a place of authority from which we have power to speak. It could be in our role as a parent or as a manager in our job. Maybe we have an elected role in the community. Maybe we're paid for our expertise professionally. We might have these formal or informal leadership roles, or maybe we're just the go-to person in our friend group that everybody comes to for advice. My question to you is, where do you have authority? Where is it? Esther's identity as a Jewish woman was something she hid. And given the context, as I said, understandable, but her identity, who she was in relationship, became a core part of her reason for speaking up and pleading for change. And so I'll pose the same question to you. Who are you? How does your gender, your age, your race, your immigration status, your physical ability, your sexuality, I could go on and on, but how does your identity impact what matters to you? How do your connections with others in your community based on your identity lead you towards compassion and action? What impact does it make to boldly claim, as did Esther, who you are? And how that ties into your reasons for using your voice for change. When Esther came before the king, she didn't just use her authority or her identity. She also gave voice to her experiences. She didn't shy away from calling out the harm that had been done and was still being done. Esther named clearly and directly the wrongs that were occurring to her and her community. She said to the king, "We've been sold. I and my people to be destroyed, sold to be massacred, eliminated." Esther confirmed her authority by claiming her identity and her experiences. Her requests to the king for change were made out of direct experience and knowledge. And so the question I'd ask you to consider is, what experiences have you had that can lead you to speak? How can who you are and what you've been through, if given voice, change the course of things for yourself and others? Friends, what I hope you can take away from this message today is that your voice matters. Who you are and what you have experienced lead you to have particular places of authority to speak into the lives of others and the broader community in ways that can make change, even when things feel hopeless. Instead of looking kind of towards these rules that are put forward by the church or by the broader community about who can and should and who's allowed to speak, I encourage you to look to the experience or the example of Esther. Identify where you have authority. Claim your identity. Acknowledge your experiences. I truly believe that God can and will use your voice. Yes, even your messy, ambiguous, confused, unsure voice to bring about hard and holy change. Choosing to use your voice when you know there's a cost isn't easy. It takes guts and courage. And so I'll leave you, as I have before, with a blessing. This is from Kate Bowler. She's an author, podcast host, and professor at Duke University. And I'll share her blessing for courage. God, I have no idea what courage is or where to get any, but I really need it. Help me in my fear. Blessed are we who say, God, fear is taking up too much space and I have little bandwidth left. If courage is a gift, then please give it. And if it is a thing for me to do, then show me how that goes. Do not let your hearts be troubled. You believe in God, believe also in me. John 14:1. For God has not given us the spirit of fear, but of power and of love and of a sound mind. 2 Timothy 1:7. So it's both. Courage is what I do, and at the same time it is given to me. That's so like you, God, to place us in this contradiction where deep listening must begin. Blessed are we who say, thank you, God, that you speak through your word, through others, and you even speak through fear, that strange friend who tells us important things for our good, but it can't tell us everything. It is but a sentinel and not our heart's home. Sit and let your fear speak. Sit longer and let your heart take courage. Amen.
We appreciate you listening online to our talks from previous weeks. For more information about our church or to see where we are currently meeting, please visit our website at www.theparish.us.